Such a pleasure to have you with us on this Tuesday on Air Talk following the three-day Memorial Day weekend. I'm Larry Mantle. So glad you're joining us on Air Talk with you all this week from 10 to noon. You can listen whenever it's convenient for you. Wherever you get your favorite podcasts, that's where you'll find Air Talk as well as at kpecc.org. Joining me now is the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, whose district includes Burbank, parts of Pasadena, Glendale, and Los Angeles. Congressman Schiff, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be with you, Larry.
Let's start, first of all, with the $3 trillion HEROES Act, which was passed by the House of Representatives and rather narrowly. But the Senate is not going to be taking it up. There's big issue of dispute over the amount of money going to states and to local jurisdictions to help them through the financial crisis of COVID-19. What sorts of prospects are there for some sort of a compromise, son of the CARES Act, so to speak?
Well, I think it's going to take some time. You know, we are taking up this week small compromises on, for example, adding flexibility to the small business program, where we will allow small businesses 24 weeks instead of 8 weeks to be able to utilize the funds and still have them forgiven. We remove the requirement that only 25% of the small business funds can be used for rent or utilities or other fixed costs. So we're taking some small steps, but in terms of the larger picture of the HEROES Act, we've reached, some divergence between the parties. One party that, is willing to let states go bankrupt. Mitch McConnell openly opining that maybe that's the answer. That is not the answer. Laying off state employees, local employees, police, firefighters, teachers, nurses, I think would add disaster on top of disaster. But we are at a point of divergence. You know, the president is out campaigning against absentee balloting, for example, whereas the states need funding to make it safe for people to vote during a pandemic. On many of these issues and others, there is a broad difference of opinion, and we're going to have to try to come to mutual agreement to get things done. But I'm not sure how much interest there is, frankly, on Mitch McConnell's part, other than confirming judges.
We'll take listener questions for Congressman Schiff. I'll pass them on to him if you have any for him. We're at 866-893-KPECC. You can ask them on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Tweet a question at Air Talk or post it on the Air Talk Facebook page. The Republican perspective on the HEROES Act that they've expressed is, when you've got so many democratically dominant states that have given such huge pension benefits to public employees, because that's the political base of financial support for Democrats in states, that then it's not right for taxpayers elsewhere to bail out states like California, they would argue, that have given such rich public employee pensions that have put them at the precipice of financial problems.
Well, you know, those same states that McConnell and other leaders are attacking are donors right now to the federal government. They're giving more to the federal government than they're getting back. Many of the other states are recipient states that are complaining right now about helping these donor states. Look, if they want to reallocate the tax burden so that California doesn't have to give as much to the federal government and it can give more to its pension funds, that's fine. But they seem to think that there's plenty of resources for bailing out large companies. They had no problem with the $2.2 trillion tax cut for large companies to do stock buybacks, executive compensation, and whatnot. They're willing to put $500 billion into a large industry fund to help save different industries, but they're willing to let states go bankrupt. And that makes no sense to me, except that they feel that, hey, look, if it doesn't affect the red states, they're not particularly interested. When, a hurricane hit Louisiana, I didn't ask whether Katrina was hitting a red state or a blue state when there needed to be relief from other natural disasters. Didn't matter to me which states were impacted. these are all Americans that we're hurting. And there are Americans around the country that are hurting right now who need help, and laying off vast numbers of state and local employees is not the answer.
We're talking with Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, who represents Burbank, Glendale, portions of Pasadena, and Los Angeles. Again, if you have questions for him, we're at 866-893-KPECC. Isn't much of the equation of who's a donor state versus a recipient, net recipient state, have to do with Social Security and the age demographics, like, you know, Florida, where you've got a lot of retirees, comparatively smaller number of young workers, California, which is a comparatively demographically young state? Isn't that one of the biggest reasons that you see that difference?
You know, I think that that certainly may be one of the contributing factors. I think it's also a part of the strength of our economy, that we generate the resources that we do, and that we pay in a percentage of those resources to federal coffers through our federal taxation, that makes us one of the biggest contributors to the federal pot. And so, you know, many of these other states are receiving largesse as a result of the work of people in California. And so when California is hurting, when we're battling this disease like other states and we need national help, then these other states, I think, and national leaders should remember that these are fellow Americans that are suffering, fellow Americans that are losing their jobs, and they're dependent on these fellow Americans to help prop up their own states in good times and in bad.
Well, the only point I was trying to make is that those that are paying in on the net contributors side, they'll be getting Social Security, we hope, down the road, which will be their payout based on what they're paying now. That was just the point that I was making.
That's certainly true.
I wanted to ask you about the Coronavirus Commission that you've proposed to take up the federal response to COVID-19 and its appearance, the rapid rate at which it spread in the United States, the shortage of testing supplies, reagent materials for the tests, the ventilators, all of these concerns early on. What is the timeline for looking back at this to try and figure out what could have been done better?
The bill that I introduced would go into effect early next year, so it wouldn't be before the election, so as to avoid it becoming a political football of any kind. The most important thing that will come out of the commission's work are recommendations based on analysis of what went wrong, how to protect the country going forward. Now, if you look at the 9/11 commission itself, and we based our legislation on the work of that commission, it took time to stand up that commission. It took a year to year and a half for the commission to do its work. Once it had done its work, it needed to continue its existence to help effectuate its recommendations. So it's a long-term project. But, you know, frankly, the severity of this, as we approach the, 100,000 American casualties, really, I think, spells out the need for a really comprehensive analysis of why, as you say, we didn't have the protective gear, we didn't have the ventilators, we had states competing with each other, outbidding each other, why we didn't respond more quickly, why containment wasn't possible. I mean, all of these problems, how we responded economically to this crisis, need to be analyzed so the country is better protected against this threat in the future. There were Republican proposals, which are very similar to mine. So there was bipartisan support for the idea. I'm sure there will be hostility by the administration that is concerned that it will come under heavy criticism for its mishandling of this, and that may be true, but that doesn't obviate the need for it. And I think what will drive this legislation, Larry, is the same thing that drove the legislation of the 9/11 Commission over the objections of the Bush administration, and that is the demand by victims that there be an honest accounting of what went wrong and how to prevent this from happening again.
We're talking with Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, Burbank, Glendale, Los Angeles, and surrounding communities. We'll continue our conversation with him. We have much more to talk about, including an issue he raised earlier, vote by mail, which is being adopted by many states because with COVID-19 and the uncertainty around the November general election, governors and legislators say they need to look at allowing people to vote more easily from home. We'll talk about the concerns that Republicans raise about doing that back in 1 minute on Air Talk. Wonderful to have you with us on the KPCC app and 89.3 KPCC. When you're home, just tell your smart speaker to play KPCC. We'll be right there with you, whatever room of the house you're in, wherever you are, if you're going into the office, and of course in your car, or wherever you have your phone with the app, you're able to listen to KPCC. Want to ask you about vote by mail. As I indicated, many states are making it uniform that everybody is mailed a ballot. Here in California, that is the directive, so everyone gets a vote by mail ballot. They can still, in Los Angeles, presumably, health measures allowing, drop it off at a vote center or choose to vote in person if they want. But Republicans have said one of their big concerns is over so-called vote harvesting. This actually occurred back in 2018 when a Republican political consultant in North Carolina gathered a bunch of absentee ballots, turning them in, and that in violation of the law in that state, which does not allow for so-called vote harvesting, or in other words, an individual unrelated to other people taking a whole group of ballots and turning them in on behalf of other individuals. I hear a lot from Democrats, Congressman Schiff, that, well, we have no examples of this, therefore we shouldn't be worried about it. But we have all kinds of things that we look at that we have worries about in advance of what could go wrong, what potential abuses there could be. Why do Democrats just downplay the potential for fraud with universal vote by mail, particularly with what's called vote harvesting?
Well, Larry, I think you're right. The only large example of this kind of attack on absentee balloting was done by Republicans in North Carolina. But the reason why, I think Democrats bridle rightly at a president who is delegitimizing everyone who votes by mail is that this is the president's way to disenfranchise people from voting in November. And he made it very obvious in a way that he sometimes does when he says the secret thing out loud, when he said 3 weeks ago that if we made it easier for people to vote by mail or through other means and more people voted, basically Republicans couldn't get elected. Now, I don't know whether that's true, but if it is true, it's a good reason for them to change their divisive platform. It's not a good reason to disenfranchise people or prevent people or making it hard for people to vote by absentee. Donald Trump isn't saying, oh, let's put some greater protections in place. He's saying, let's just not do it, except for me, Donald Trump, because I don't want to go to Florida to vote where I'm now registered.
But if we see that the president's comments are just naked political gain, that that's not a legitimate reason to say, well, we're not going to have vote by mail because it hurts Republicans. Is there not still a legitimate argument separate from that, that there does need to be more attention paid to the ability of people to pressure groups of individuals to vote a certain way, to sign those ballots and turn them in? Do you not have any concern about that?
You know, Larry, my bigger concern, honestly, at the moment is that the President of the United States will force people in November to choose their health or their vote. And my other concern, based on what he is saying, is that he is going to cast into doubt the legitimacy of millions of people who vote by mail if he loses the election. That is my paramount concern right now. And yes, can we always improve protections against any kind of voter mischief? Absolutely. But you know, Larry, the biggest problem we have in voter fraud is not people voting by absentee. It's not people voting in person. It's people who are paid a buck a signature to gather voter registrations, who make up registrations that don't actually result in people voting, but because they get paid for those cards when they turn them in, they make up a bunch of phony cards. That's actually what we see with some frequency. So if we want to talk about problems we see with frequency, that's the one we should be attacking. But really, you know, the president does this over and over, and I think people sort of fall into the trap. He makes statements that are completely unsupported, that are completely false and baseless. And we, you know, bend all over ourselves to say, oh, isn't there some kernel of truth, some grain of truth that we can find in this to justify or rationalize, when the much bigger threat staring us in the face is they're making an effort to force people to choose their health or their vote this fall. And it's unconscionable. And they're taking steps right now to delegitimize the result of the election, which in a democracy is also unconscionable. And to me, those are the far greater fears I have than the Republicans will do what they did again in North Carolina, albeit that is a concern. But it is not one that overrides the legitimacy of the process of voting by mail.
It also is likely going to delay the results. If this is a close election, delay it considerably, because you're going to have so many ballots turned in on election day that are gathered en masse that to determine all the signatures are valid, whatnot, could be weeks before we have the result. But let's move on and talk about the other issue in which you've certainly been in the news lately, and that is the, up until today, Interim Director of National Intelligence Richard Grenell revealed who requested the unmasking of National Security Advisor Michael Flynn's name in intelligence report on Russia's efforts to affect the 2016 election. The names included multiple Obama administration officials, including Vice President Joe Biden. Why would individuals, and I understand this is pretty routine, and there are thousands of complied with approved unmasking requests annually among federal officials, but what would the reasons be that individuals like the vice president would want the name unmasked?
Yeah. Well, first of all, what people need to realize, because the Trump administration and its allies like Grenell have been talking sort of fast and loose about what results they have just selectively declassified. It's not that these officials were saying, show me whatever conversations you have with Mike Flynn and unmask Mike Flynn's name. No, the process is you would get a report, an intelligence report, that would show a U.S. person's name redacted, and it would say U.S. person instead of their name to protect their privacy. And you get this report and you don't know who the masked person is. But you also can't understand the significance of what you're reading without knowing who it is. And so there's a process where you can request the unmasking of the name. So when officials requested that certain reports be unmasked, they may have had no idea who that U.S. person was and only found out when it was unmasked. So the impression that the administration, the president, others have given that they sought to unmask Michael Flynn is in itself misleading. They sought to understand intelligence reports, and when they asked who is this person referred to as U.S. person one, then they were informed of that identity. What you didn't see were all the other unmasking reports that had nothing to do with Michael Flynn, because Rick Grenell didn't want to share that information with the public because he wanted to give the public a misleading impression of something the president calls Obamagate. And this is, I think, really quite transparent. These are unmasking requests that took place years ago. So why is Rick Grenell, whose only qualification really is that of being a partisan Trump loyalist, why is he selectively declassifying information now in the run-up to an election? And the answer is because it's the run-up to an election. To me, that's the greater risk to the intelligence process, the way Grenell has been politicizing it.
We'll continue with Adam Schiff, Democratic Congressman, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. His district includes Burbank, Glendale, portions of Los Angeles, and Pasadena. We'll be back in just 1 minute on Air Talk. Coming up in our second hour of Air Talk, we'll talk with you about what you saw over the course of the Memorial Day weekend while out and about in the world as people were enjoying themselves in the warm days. Were they also being careful about keeping distance, covering their faces, doing the things we need to do to try and help prevent the spread of COVID-19? We'll talk about that next hour. And also, our political analyst will be with us to talk about the biggest political news of the past week. With us right now, Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff of Burbank. He's the chair of the House Intelligence Committee and was the lead prosecutor of President Trump during the Senate impeachment trial of the president. Congressman, in transcripts of confidential testimony presented to your committee, no one provides any proof of Trump campaign officials working with Russian operatives to harm the Clinton campaign. Yet your critics have pointed out how you were regularly going on news programs at that same time that testimony was being taken, saying there was more than circumstantial evidence, there was collusion in plain sight, calling it beyond Watergate. Why the disconnect between the testimony that you were being given at the time and what you were publicly saying at the time?
There is no disconnect, but I disagree strongly with the predicate of your question that there was no evidence in the transcripts. That's what the president is saying, but that's not a reflection of what's actually in the transcripts. When you read the transcripts, much like the Mueller report, what you see is you see, in fact, the Russians reaching out to the Trump campaign, in fact, putting it in writing, offering dirt on the Clinton campaign, which they describe as part of the Russian government's effort to help Mr. Trump. And you see the Trump campaign accept. You see the president's own son saying, if it's what you say it is, then we would love it. And the best time is late summer. You see the president's campaign setting up a secret meeting with the Russians in Trump Tower in New York, with the president's son and son-in-law and the campaign chairman. You see them lying about that meeting, saying it never took place. You see them lying about the meeting when it was discovered and what was said in the meeting. You see the Russians informing the Trump campaign that they, through George Papadopoulos, that they have thousands of stolen Clinton emails and they can help by anonymously releasing them. You see Roger Stone in communication with WikiLeaks trying to get advanced information about the release of the Russian stolen materials from the Clinton campaign. All of that is in the transcript. All of that is evidence of collusion. So your predicate is wrong, but it's the Trump line. But we have to keep pointing out, as we did when the Mueller report came out, it's just not consistent. That Trump line is just not consistent with what is actually in the transcripts. The evidence that I mentioned, the Trump campaign sharing polling data, Paul Manafort, the campaign chairman sharing polling data, internal polling data, with someone linked to Russian intelligence. Of course, that's evidence of collusion. It would be admissible in any court in the land. So, we have to keep on going back to these facts to counter the misinformation, but it's there in the transcripts.
So you think it was wrong then that the special prosecutor did not prosecute over those contacts between the Trump campaign and Russians?
Well, what I said before the Mueller report even came out, Larry, and I said this repeatedly on Sunday shows and elsewhere, there's a difference between evidence of collusion and whether you can prove the crime of conspiracy beyond a reasonable doubt. And that I would defer to Mueller on the latter, but just what was in plain sight in that Trump Tower meeting in New York, in the provision of polling data to people linked to Russian intelligence, in all of these connections between the Trump campaign and the Russians and the president's touting the WikiLeaks disclosure every time they were made more than 100 times in the campaign trail, Mueller's own conclusion that the Trump campaign invited and welcomed Russian interference and made full use of it, built a campaign messaging strategy around that, all of that is, of course, evidence of collusion. Mueller reached the conclusion that he couldn't prove to a jury beyond a reasonable doubt that each element of the crime of conspiracy was met. That's a different standard. And we don't hold presidential campaigns, at least we shouldn't, to the standard merely of what you can prove beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury in terms of a violation of the criminal law. What the Trump campaign did was, I think, most Americans' understanding of what collusion is. It's unethical. It's immoral. It may be criminal. And the reason ultimately Mueller concluded he couldn't prosecute the conspiracy was that he couldn't show that Don Jr. and Manafort and Kushner knew what they were doing in agreeing to accept dirt from the Russians was illegal, even though it was illegal. Now, I can quarrel with that. Paul Manafort had run presidential campaigns. I think he knew exactly what he was doing. But that was Mueller's conclusion, and I accept it.
Yeah, but all those Obama administration officials who testified before your committee said they had no evidence of an active effort on the part of the campaign and Russian operatives to try and affect the election.
Not exactly, no. What they said was that they were not in a position, because they were not involved in the investigation, to know what the full evidence was. But what they were seeing was deeply concerning to them. That's really what their testimony said.
All right. Congressman, always a pleasure. Thank you, sir, for being with us. Thank you for joining us, and stay well.
Thank you,
Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff of Burbank joining us on Air Talk.